All right. Welcome to the Cava Ships podcast, where we try and cut through the fog and the murk, shine a bit of light on naval and maritime issues of the day. I'm Chris Cavas.
And I'm Chris Cervello.
The Cava Ships podcast is sponsored by GE Aerospace. The LM2500 family of marine gas turbines are renowned for being the workhorse for the U.S. Navy and 38 navies around the world. Find out more about GE Aerospace's marine engines and systems at geaerospace.com/marine. And by HII. Join HII at the Navy League's Sea Air Space Expo at the Gaylord National Convention Center, April 8th through 10th. HII is committed to delivering the platforms and technologies from aircraft carriers and Flight 3 destroyers to C5ISR and LVC solutions that create the advantage for our customers as they protect peace and freedom around the world. HII, Booth 1323.
Coming up, Dr. Jerry Hendricks and Brian McGrath join us to discuss the Navy's 45-day ship review and what to look forward to at next week's Sea, Air, and Space Symposium in National Harbor, Maryland. But first, a look at naval news this week.
The U.S. Navy began rolling out the results of what it called a 45-day shipbuilding review on April 2nd. Ordered by Navy Secretary Carlos Del Toro, the review, full details of which remain to be released, validated earlier reports of continuing or increased delays to a number of key programs, including the Columbia-class ballistic missile submarine, Virginia-class attack submarines, the Enterprise CVN-80, the Constellation-class frigate, and the next TAGOS ocean surveillance ships. Delays to the frigate have now reached 36 months, or 3 years behind the original delivery date of 2026. The service cited a variety of problems leading to the delays, including design maturity, supply chain issues, and workforce issues. While the programs just named were cited for particular concern, several programs were judged as stable and tracking to program manager schedule estimates, including Bougainville-class assault ships, San Antonio-class amphibious ships, John Lewis-class fleet oilers, and Flight 3 Arleigh Burke-class destroyers.
The USS Boxer Amphibious Ready Group has finally deployed after weeks of delays forced the unit's three ships to leave the U.S. West Coast at widely separate times. Amphibious ship Somerset left in January to begin the ARG's deployment with the 15th Marine Expeditionary Unit. Harper's Ferry got underway March 19th to begin the deployment, having been delayed by several maintenance issues. And Boxer herself left San Diego April 1st to catch up to the two other ships delayed by numerous mechanical and certification issues. The 15th MEU is the first Marine unit to deploy with the Amphibious Combat Vehicle, or ACV, successor to the long-serving AAV, Assault Amphibious Vehicle. Toward the end of the deployment, the ACVs will be dropped off in Okinawa to join the Japan-based 31st Marine Expeditionary Unit. The 15th MEU's MV-22 Osprey tiltrotor aircraft were left behind in California, still undergoing a reactivation program after a three-month grounding earlier this year, since lifted.
Houthi missile and unmanned vehicle attacks continued in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden region, but without causing significant damage. U.S. forces destroyed several Houthi unmanned aerial systems in the air and on the ground, U.S. Central Command said, along with anti-ship ballistic missiles and at least one unmanned surface vessel. The destroyer USS Gravely engaged and destroyed an inbound anti-ship ballistic missile on April 3rd, headed, CENTCOM said, for the ship.
Denmark fired its top military officer April 4th in the aftermath of a power failure in March aboard the frigate Iver Huitfeldt in the Red Sea. Around the time the frigate engaged and destroyed four Houthi unmanned aircraft using ESSM, Evolved Sea Sparrow missiles, General Fleming Lenfer apparently failed to report to the government that the frigate's radar and missile systems were offline for about 30 minutes during the drone attack. The Iver Huitfeldt returned April 4th as scheduled to her base in Denmark after a deployment of just over 2 months to support U.S.-led Operation Prosperity Guardian. Despite the system's failure, the engagement seems to have been the first using the U.S.-built ESSM, a lower-cost defensive missile than the standard SM-2 missiles used against the unmanned aircraft by U.S. destroyers.
And that's a look at just some of this week's naval news.
All right, we are ready to get into the discussion portion of the podcast. And as we mentioned at the top, we are delighted to be joined by friends of the pod and return guests, Dr. Jerry Hendricks and Brian McGrath, both noted navalists and commenters on the Navy, where it is, where it should be. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us again on the Cavas Ships podcast.
It's great to be here.
Earlier this week, the Navy released what some are calling a rare public accounting of the major delays, none of which I think were a surprise in key shipbuilding programs. The big ones that the report outlined were the 12 to 16 month delay, expected delay in the first Columbia class submarine, the 36 to 24 month delay in the fourth and fifth blocks of the Virginia class, 36 month delay in the first Constellation class frigate, and the 26-month delay in the Carrier Enterprise, CVN 80, you know, and we were saying before we came on the air, I mean, there has not really been a report per se. It's a couple pages at most, and then there's been the commentary and the reporting. Jerry, I'll start with you. Your thoughts on this 45-day review and some of the findings and where the Navy goes from here.
Well, you know, first of all, again, kind of a unofficial official document, kind of an interesting approach, trying to sell the bad news. It's almost like, did they dump this at, 6 o'clock on Friday before a holiday weekend? You know, you would almost kind of expect that. That being said, the story itself, you know, the fact that, as a friend of mine just told me earlier this morning, you know, if your body hurts, you know, and you know, you go around your body and you poke it with your finger at every place that hurts on the body, the greater possibility here is that the problem is the finger that keeps poking these things. The fact that we're having these widespread issues in shipbuilding and delays in shipbuilding across all of these programs suggests that, in fact, the issue isn't necessarily all with the shipbuilders. And I'm not saying that the problem isn't, you know, in some cases with shipbuilders. Clearly, COVID and workforce are common issues across all of these programs. But there's also a broader issue, which is if you're having this many problems across this many programs, there's obviously an issue within the Navy and Naval Sea Systems Command, which is a point that I've made in a couple of occasions here. You know, we're looking at, with regard to Virginia, is, you know, we're looking at blocks 3, 4, and 5 under development right now. So we really haven't had, quote unquote, a stable fast attack submarine program. The issues with the Ford class that were highlighted here, well, you know, Ford class has been very much an experimentation in progress all the way through its development, and we're still working out the kinks. FREM, or the frigate, Constellation class frigate, you know, the point that was made in the article that originally it was 85% commonality with the European FREM, and now it's down to 15% due to 12 major ship alts, and also issues not only with the hull, but also HEM&E, but also with the combat system, which is where a lot of these other delays are coming from. These are issues in mission growth, and then that is causing impacts and delays in the program. So I think it highlights that there's challenges both in shipbuilding as well as at NAVSEA.
Brian, your take, and I particularly your take on, you know, who's to blame, or is there any point in, you know, assigning blame?
In order to properly evaluate causality, one has to go back to root causes, and that invariably is connected to blame. I start with the most obvious thing, the fact that the United States Navy went nearly 3 years without a Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Research, Development, and Acquisition. Now, I get there were acting people and yada, yada, yada. But if we are content with acting people, then we shouldn't have the billet to begin with. We have a Senate-confirmed billet because we expect that person to be able to act with speed, alacrity, and strength. More so than a political appointee, Schedule C, or a SES gap filler. So I think number one, we have this this atmospheric sense that it just wasn't important. It just wasn't important to the president, the national security advisor, the secretary of defense, et al. Right. Number one. Number two, we have for years tuned down the shipbuilding industrial base to a point where it was capable of building the limited number of ships that we believed we need to meet our peacetime needs. We did a wonderful job of managing and reducing capacity in a way that left us with zero ability to flex. And so we are reaping the whirlwind of 30 years of hits and oversight at NAVC and the acquisition workforce, hits on the yards themselves as they have gotten down smaller and smaller and smaller. If you get some of the figures of how many employees the big yards had 30 years ago versus today, it's just astounding how much smaller they are. Now, some of that is automation. I get that, but it's more demand. I'm going to stay in blaming the demand signal, right? We a long time ago in this country, 40 some odd years ago, decided that we were going to break the Mahanian connection between a civilian shipbuilding industry and a military shipbuilding industry. We have done that. We have managed to build the world's most capable and sophisticated ships for 40 years in the absence of a robust civilian shipbuilding industry. So I sometimes wrestle with the sense of the connection between those things. I'm sympathetic that they might be connected, but at the end of the day, if you're going to walk away from civilian shipbuilding, you damn sure can't walk away from military shipbuilding if you want to continue to build sophisticated, capable warships. And while we haven't walked away from it, we haven't cared about it. We haven't fed it. We haven't given it predictable demand. And then there are the workforce issues. We are a country that tells young people you aren't worthwhile unless you go to college. We haven't seen a beer commercial with a dude with a lunch pail walking out of a shipyard in 50 years. We have, as a society, walked away from from this sense of skilled trades having a place of honor in our society, being able to support a family on that. And so, again, reaping the whirlwind of our society's evolution over decades and decades to the point where we cannot get the nose up on this fighter without significant, in my view, federal government intervention. This hurts me to say. I'm a conservative. But the Navy doesn't practice free markets. It protects them. The Navy doesn't. The Navy is all about. The Navy's like the post office, right? We have to. It's right there in the Constitution. We've got to do it. We're not going to subcontract this out to somebody else. This is a federal responsibility, and the federal government needs to get its act together, needs to get involved in recruiting even more. It needs to get involved in workforce issues even more. It needs to directly invest even more in capital improvement. This is industrial policy. I get that, but I'm okay with that. Over.
Jerry, I'll go back to you, and then I want to go to Chris Cavas, who was at the press conference, as I said, earlier this week, and then was at a press conference yesterday with HII's CEO, Chris Kastner. But Jerry, go ahead. You had your hand up.
Yeah, so I just want to lay in there on what Brian just said and emphasize my support for where he's coming from. You know, we industrial policy generally amongst Republicans is a bad word or a bad phrase. I think, quite frankly, we need, and I've written this, that we need a CHIPS Act in line with the CHIPS Act that actually sets out a plan, a goal for re-expansion of the industrial base. And the reason why I say that, and I can say that as a conservative myself as well, is that we had a role, we, the United States government, had a role in restricting and in compressing and deflating the defense industrial base in this country. You know, I've written about the Last Supper and its impact upon the defense industrial base, going from 107 major contractors down to five primes. We're going to have a role. We, the U.S. government, we, the Pentagon, we, the Department of Defense, are going to have a role in reinflating that to actually, and I'm not looking to break up the primes. I'm looking that as opportunities present themselves, that we add to that industrial base by selectively choosing people that we are companies we want to invest in to bring additional capacity and resiliency back to that market. Over.
Chris, your thoughts, both as somebody that's watched this for a very long time, but then also somebody that was involved in the, you know, two critical parts of the conversation this week.
I'm really trying to figure out what is the goal here? And this is coming from the Navy. And by the way, the Navy doesn't really want to talk about this stuff and explain it. So the Secretary himself, ever since he rolled out his latest series of criticisms, which I think began in January February at the West Conference with a very, very provocative speech. But that was also followed up by the lack of any Q&A and no interviews and no discussion in more detail. What do you mean by this? What do you mean by that? Would you like to explain that further? They're avoiding this. I'm not sure what that strategy is all about, because an awful lot of what he's talking about absolutely begs for more detail. What are you getting at here? What's your aim? What prompted you to say that? And they're actively not doing that. And there's always something else coming up. There's always something new. We're not looking for anything, for example, at the upcoming Sierra Space Exposition, because there's going to be the first of a posture hearing is going to be on Thursday. So, you know, the story is everything wants to be saved for that. All right. Well, there's always something. But I don't know what they're getting at. I always bristle at this discussion about shipbuilding writ large, this very broad brush that people like to paint it with. And the fact of the matter is it's incredibly intricate, and solutions and problems that are peculiar to a certain location and a certain program are not appropriate for other locations and other programs. Works for that one, works for that one, does not work for that one, kind of works for that one, doesn't work at all for that one. And this broad brush approach, I think, rankles an awful lot of people, especially in the industry, because they know that this is incredibly complex. The idea that, you know, a program is behind, what are we going to do about it? Well, you know, this just in, the fact that the program exists means that the program is behind. No program is on time. Please tell me what Pollyanna person came along and said, I thought they were always on time. No, they're not. So is that a problem we have to do something about? Or is that just a natural condition that you manage? And there's no discussion about that. The other thing that, you know, all these shipbuilders all throughout the industry, especially the shipbuilders who put the ships together, they share two things in common. One is that most of them are near some body of water, be it, you know, a small creek or a bay or right off an ocean or right off the Gulf of Mexico or something. And they all share a common customer. And the common customer is not in any of these criticisms. There's no partnership going on here. So it's really just a blame game. It's all their fault, and everybody should be doing better, and you guys should be doing better. It's sort of like, you know, management telling the ball club, you got to play better. Well, you also got to manage better, and you got to have a better front office, and you got to get some better players. And they're leaving all of that out of it. It's just like, it's all your fault. And yeah, there are issues there. You can't deny it. But that's not the story. And I don't hear, I hear all this, what's the problem? What's the problem? There's no, the overriding discussion I would prefer would be, we want to make it better. We acknowledge everybody's trying. I don't know anybody's not trying. If you talk to any industry, they're going, what are they talking about? We are putting all kinds of investment in our plants, in our people, in everything they can think of to turn this stuff around. And everybody's doing that. That's not just HII or just General Dynamics. All of them are doing this to varying degrees, some of them incredibly large degrees. And they're immensely frustrated because they're all being lumped together. And this is not a very, very intelligent discussion. I don't think, and I think that gets to the heart of the matter. Is this an intelligent discussion or not? Or is this just a blame game? And at the moment, my sense is that it's a blame game.
Let's assume that we want to get to a point where it does turn into an intelligent discussion. Brian, you mentioned the federal government. The two key players in the federal government would be, in the Pentagon, the Navy, and then across the river on Capitol Hill. What could the Navy do with Congress? What should Congress do? I mean, how do we get ourselves out of this? Like, what is not happening that should? Brian, first you, then Jerry.
I would like to see some sort of inducement for people to physically relocate. We have pockets of unemployment in this country. Unemployment is low, don't get me wrong, but we have pockets of unemployment. We have pockets of decay and industrial diminishment. But people don't move from those places with skills to places where the jobs are. Number one, it's disruptive. Number two, it's expensive. Number three, it's tough on your family. And number four, you're just chasing another chimera at that point. A predictable demand signal, and then some sort of a centralized federal, I don't know whether it's a tax incentive. I don't know what it is, but we have to get people with skills to move. We have to incentivize them to move to where the jobs are. There are jobs at these shipyards for welders and electricians and pipe fitters and all those things. And there are pipe fitters and electricians and welders throughout our country. We have to create a better, like a dating service for industry and labor. I think that's a really good start and something that I would be happy to contribute brain power to. Over.
Jerry, your thoughts. I mean, where can Congress help move this along? Brian threw out an idea. It's a good one. I mean, you had mentioned the Ships Act. I mean, something like what Brian just described could be part of a Ships Act. But I mean, where else do we need to go?
Yeah. So, you know, the fact is historically the Navy expands, the Navy grows, the Navy strengthens when there's a complete alignment within the U.S. government. And that's an alignment that only happens, well, let's put it less regularly than a total solar eclipse. So, you know, we can look at the late 1880s. We can look at the Roosevelt administration, Theodore Roosevelt administration. Then you can look at, you know, Reagan to Lehman. The fact of the matter is, you know, when we created the Department of Defense and the Office of Secretary of Defense, we put this figure between the Secretary of the Navy and the President of the United States in the SecDef's office. And unless the SecDef, you know, the one thing we've seen, and we saw this in the last administration, where Mark Esper sort of stepped in as Secretary of Defense, you know, or as I like to call it, Secretary of the Army Super, and essentially took control of the Navy shipbuilding budget and the entire Navy conversation with the Congress. And until the Congress comes back and said, okay, Secretary of Defense, if you want to be in charge of the Navy, fine, I'm going to bring you up here and I'm going to lambaste you about the head and shoulders repeatedly until you get me my answers. The other thing, too, is I don't think that the Sea Power subcommittees have taken their role seriously. You know, there is no Vinson, there is no Stennis right now in there. You know, I look there and you know, I'm sure that Senator Kramer is a marvelous, you know, human being, a great public servant. But the fact is, He has no exposure to the Navy and no background on the Navy. And yet that is a chairman of the Senate Sea Power Subcommittee. And so, or, I'm sorry, he's the ranking member on that. So where's the expertise? Where's the drive here?
Soon there'll be no Mike Gallagher. Yeah.
Well, and let's face it, Mike Gallagher wasn't there. The House made sure that Mike Gallagher was moved over to the essentially the CFIUS, you know, the being in charge of that. He wasn't on Sea Power. And in fact, Sea Power, you know, went to Representative Kelly of Mississippi, you know, who doesn't represent HII. He actually he's a, you know, National Guard guy who's upstate Mississippi. My point here is we're not seeing that level of expertise, nor is there leadership at the White House level. You know, I know that there's someone in the White House who's in charge of AUKUS. There's like a special assistant to the president on AUKUS. But do I think that that person's meeting with Joe Biden and that Joe Biden is talking with Lloyd Austin and saying, make this happen and here's A, B, and C, D that I want you to do in order to make, there is no alignment of the planets. There is no solar eclipse to bring this about. And until we get that, so, you know, Brian covered the micro level. I'm talking macro level here on, and we have to have something that meets in the middle. Until you have someone that's kind of like Todd Young, who shepherded the CHIPS Act through, until you have that champion emerge to shepherd through a CHIPS Act, who takes a broad view of shipbuilding and ship repair industrial base and crafts that legislation in a bipartisan fashion, and then drives it through the House and the Senate, you're not going to see the type of movement we need. And honestly, what I fear is that unlike Vinson, that, you know, because Vinson got the Navy rolling prior to Pearl Harbor, and the ships that hit the fleet in 42 and 43 were bought in 38, 39. Right now, we don't have anything like that surge coming. So even those of us who say, well, it's going to take another Pearl Harbor before everyone wakes up, well, even that will be a disaster because we have nothing on the way right now. We have an anemic industrial base that Brian's already covered well, and we don't have a plan on how to rapidly expand that. And I'm looking for that white knight champion that I can sidle up next to and whisper in their ear and tell them how it's going to be done or should be done. And right now I look around, I can't find that person.
I'll ask all of you, and I know this is a little bit of a broken record on this pod, and you know there are folks that have kind of poked us for it, but my experience tells me that that white knight doesn't just suddenly show up, that the Navy has to help create that white knight. And whether you want 355 ships, whether you want 300 ships, whether you want 400 ships, whether you want to focus on shipbuilding or ship repair, the Navy needs to do its part in informing and helping the Congress focus on these issues. Why are they not doing that? Chris Cavas first, and then I'll ask the two of you. I'm interested in your take. Where is the Navy in helping Congress help itself?
I mean, if you talk to the Navy, they say they're doing fine. The Navy will confidently say, oh, no, we're talking to all the right people. We are confident that we're communicating our position to the Hill. I don't see it. I don't hear it. But that's what I get from the Navy. I don't know. I don't have a good answer for that. I mean, that's sort of the big vexing question of our time is that this is not how you sell a higher investment in the maritime. And I mean the maritime writ large, not just shipbuilding, but the importance of a Navy and a maritime industry and the support systems and everything. We're having all these events pop up right now that are showing the importance of sea power in the Red Sea and the peaceful transition of commerce on an international level, sea power on the ports. The Port of Baltimore is closed today. No, you know, that's not permanent, but we're already seeing ripple effects all around the country for that closure. This is important stuff. A Navy is sort of the guarantor, what underpins the security of all that. But they're not selling that. And when they do sell it, it's only parts of it. You know, war fighting first. Okay, well, war fighting, does it meet the Chinese? As the Chinese are coming across the Taiwan Strait? Well, that's not sea power. It's an element of sea power. But it shouldn't be the focus. All this other stuff is, and all this other stuff includes the shipbuilding industry and infrastructure. And it's important to just create, you know, I mean, this is important. and just create an awareness of the impact. And now events are conspiring to do that for the Navy. Ride with it, roll with it. These things, you know, the absence of opportunism, you know, when history provides you an opportunity, jump at it. Don't have a meeting about it. Don't think about it. Grab it now, because if you don't, it's gone. These opportunities, you can't see them coming and they don't last. But if you, you know, ride that pony when it comes in. And I think they're, you know, again, I don't know, how many metaphors can we do? Missing the boat.
Brian, you know, when you talk to the Navy, and I hear the same thing that Chris Cavas does, they look at a percentage of the budget, an increase in the budget. They have their own metrics and they say, hey, we're doing just fine. Like, what are you worried about? And I don't know that they're doing just fine. Your thoughts, you wrote on this a little bit this week about the proportionality of the investments. Your thoughts on if the Navy is doing just fine, or should they be doing more to create that white knight that Jerry talks about?
The Navy is not doing just fine. I do not hear from the people I talk to that the Navy is doing just fine. But I am sensitive to the rules of the game. And the rules of the game right now are that Carlos Del Toro, Lisa Franchetti, and Jim Kilby are not going to prosper in the political environment that they work in, because it is a political environment that they work in. By standing up and shouting about how great the Navy is doing in the Red Sea, how we need to fund more of this, we need to do all the things that Jerry and I and Chris and you are discussing. If you think for a second that Del Toro, Franchetti, or Kilby wouldn't do backflips if they were offered an extra $30 billion next fiscal year, you're crazy. They would find places for that money immediately. So my problem is that the structure that we have set up for senior military and senior political people to do their jobs in keeps them from doing their job. OSD sitting atop the services, the service secretary being somewhat diminished in capacity, power, staffing, throw weight from what they used to be. All of these things play in. I know that Del Toro, Kilby, and Franchetti would like more money. I know they think we're not big enough to do our job. But they have very powerful people above them who are either not interested in what the Navy is interested in, or they plain disagree. I honestly believe that there is a cabal on the third deck of the Pentagon that really, really questions whether powerful forward presence makes any difference. And so I have advised my friends in government to stop talking about forward presence. Talk about the missions that we accomplish from being forward. Because as soon as you talk about forward presence, some numbnut on the third deck is going to start talking about, oh, that's just self-licking ice cream cones and admirals wanting to put ships forward because that's what admirals do, and they don't get it. They don't respect it. The final thing is my confidence in saying this comes from how they entered office. They entered office with this concept of integrated deterrence, which they've stopped talking about when the world punched them in the face. But this concept of integrated deterrence was all about bringing some of the Navy home, not being forward and operating to the extent that it is, and being able to operate from a surge or a sustainment capacity because other elements of the government were going to take up that slack. It didn't work. It isn't working. Conventional deterrence means you got to be there. Over.
Jerry, your thoughts?
Well, you know, given that softball that Brian just tossed right out there for me to smack, You know, this whole Bob Workian paradox that essentially is sort of driving this idea that presence is destroying the Navy. And he wrote a very, you know, well-penned, well-placed essay in Naval Institute Proceedings, I think, 2 years ago, December, where he advanced this argument that we're breaking the Navy on naval presence, and that we need, in many ways, I mean, the synthesis of the argument is, as Brian just said, that we need to return home sort of in our pre-World War II, 1930s surge and exercise paradigm, stop being forward deployed. That would allow us to get smaller, and getting smaller will allow us to invest more in R&D and art in this divest to invest aspect that there's a lot of advocacy for. I completely agree. That's where OSD is. That's where Kath Hicks is. That's where, you know, they are right now. If you're talking to R&E or acquisitions, you know, that's where they're one and believe in this sort of third offset leap ahead capability is suddenly going to allow us to have one ship that's able to cover the planet ultimately. But what they fail to do, and this is a point, you know, I did a study a year ago, October, talking about the value of naval presence, trying to demonstrate in a mathematical model, you know, simulated environment, you know, what the value of naval presence is. And the thing that no one wants to come to grips with is that, you know, the one historical example that we have that's recent in a modern enough time that we can look at and say that that has applicability, which is when, you know, Lord Jackie Fisher culled 137 ships out of the British Royal Navy in order to make the investment in Dreadnought, and then also the advanced heavy cruiser that went along with the Dreadnought battleship. When he pulled all those ships back, decommissioned them to free up manpower and money to invest in this new high tech, he created power vacuums throughout the globe, across the British international system. I wrote about this in Foreign Policy about 2 years ago. And what in that vacuum, essentially that unleashed the other colonial imperial powers in Europe to start moving out to try and take advantage of Britain stepping back. You know, Germany and a bunch of the other Dutch, they all stepped up. They saw it was jump ball and they wanted to grab market share in the global trade system. This caused instability. That instability, which begins in 1903 with the divestment movement by Fisher, that, you know, comes to be in 1914 with the outbreak of World War I. And so my concern right now is for all these divest to invest and let's shrink the fleet and come home and do surge and exercise, you are creating vacuums that powers like Russia, like China, are more than willing to step into. And then in that stepping in, you create these spheres of influence. Multipolar environments are much more unstable than bipolar or unipolar environments. And we are, boom, off to the races in some sort of a global conflagration. We don't accept the lessons of history. We don't think that they apply to us today in our modern setting. Americans tend to think that, Lord, we get up every morning and get to reinvent the world ourselves because we're Americans. Well, it doesn't work like that. You need to respect the system. And as the Bull Durham says, you gotta respect the streak. You know, if you think that's the reason why you're winning, then you've got to respect why you're winning. We're not respecting why we were winning. We're pulling back from naval presence in our fleet, and we will, you know, we will reap the whirlwind.
So next week is the sort of the biggest event of the year for the naval community. I believe all four of us will be there in some form or fashion. And I look forward to seeing you guys. But as we head into that, what do you hope to hear, whether it's more of what we've talked about or whether it's from industry or others? Brian, I'll start with you, and then we'll kind of go around the horn. But what do you hope to hear next week? What are you looking forward to seeing as you walk around the floor?
You know, I'm a big fan of the Lombardi, Vince Lombardi, when he warned Paul Hornung about celebrating in the end zone, he said something about act like you've been there before. The problem is we haven't been here before. What we're seeing in the Red Sea right now is a large scale validation of decades of programming, of improvement, of capability increases, because industry and action officers talk to each other and and came up with solutions to hard operational problems and applied resources against them. And slowly over time, over decades, even in a peacetime drawdown, we have created a series of a basket of capability there that is the envy of the world. I want to hear Navy leaders brag about that. I want to hear Navy leaders point at these victories and about, I want to see, yes, there are all sorts of examples of coal screw-ups in the industrial base over time. I get it. Those are the ones that make the news. Those are the ones that make us all, turn us all into socialists. But the bottom line is we have done a lot of really important things right over time. I want to see Navy leaders talk about that. I want to see Navy leaders pointing in the future and saying, that's where we're going and we're going to do that right. Also, I want to see some swagger because we deserve it right now.
That's a great point. Jerry, your thoughts?
I completely endorse what he just said. I'd love to see the SWOs come out and say, did you see that? Did you see that? We knocked down everything that flew. You know, we are essentially batting 1,000 right now. And the only reason we're not batting totally 1,000 is we don't have enough ships. And can you give me more ships? Because if you give me more ships, I can do that. I have that capability. And by the way, we're investing in the future. We're looking at new weapon system. We are looking at trying to invest in that generational lead that we've demonstrated just now. I think naval aviation can step up and say, hey, look at how we did this. You know, yeah, we had to pivot to do something that's non-standard, but we adjusted just as naval aviation always has adjusted. Do I think that this automatically translates over to the South China Sea? No, I don't. I don't. But at the same time, this is where we're at. In the world that we live in now, we're looking pretty damn good. Now, I like to see the submarine guys come up and talk about where they're at. And I'd love to see them talk about that honestly. I'd love to talk about how they're not only getting at where they're at on new ship construction and growing their workforce. And they have these distributed, disaggregated factories where they're building components for submarine industrial base. To get at Brian's earlier point, like, hey, we need to move construction to where the workforce is. And the submarine community is doing that. This submarine industrial base initiative is looking for where those workers are, and they're moving jobs in those areas. I want to hear them talk about that. But I also want them to talk about what their solution set is on submarine repair and how they're going to handle, you know, issues with some of these boats that have been pierside for years and apparently will be pierside for years more. And how we're going to attack that. So I'm looking for good news, bad news stories. I think, quite frankly, you know, I want to see good news celebrated. We have a moment to celebrate here. And I want to see bad news confronted like adults, like we're all adults in the room and we can handle bad news. And quite frankly, if the congressmen are walking around the floor or if they're not because they're all in committee hearings this next week, I can understand that, but their staffers will be there. You know, I know chiefs of staff, they're going to be over there. They're going to hear this, but quite frankly, you know, I do understand I'm an adult. It's a presidential election year. And suddenly, you know, the Navy will once again feel some love and attention as, you know, presidents come up and talk about what they've done or not done. And so I think we all need to be adults and figure out how to leverage the moment we're in and ride the wave. It may not be a big wave. You know, this isn't a 28 footer coming in on a West Coast beach, but it's big enough that we can get a surge of impetus, of energy. Let's try and paddle hard and get up on that wave.
Chris Cavas, you like to spend the majority of your time down on the floor talking to folks. What do you hope to hear? What do you expect to hear?
Well, I think, you know, industry is going to be, industry always wants to talk. Industry's got products, they want to sell it. Industry has no problem talking. But they, you know, it's, we'll see what the Navy does. You know, it took like Naval Sea Systems Command until I think last night to finally release their briefing schedule very, very late in the whole thing, in the whole process. Usually, you know, it should come out at least a week before. But, you know, it's a pretty thin briefing. It's too bad that a lot of the programs that are out there that are, they've not done a briefing on for a long time, they're not doing briefings on. And it is too bad, because this is not a complete. The impression people get right now is this is all gloom and doom. Even the briefing for the 45-day review focused on the key, I don't know, problem areas, right? The big delays in the submarine programs, the big delay in the CVN-80, the Enterprise, the aircraft carrier, the big delays in the frigate. They didn't talk about, they don't want to talk about, I don't know why, even the same report. There are multiple programs at multiple shipyards that are not major problem areas. And this is by the Navy's own reckoning. It's all buried at the bottom in the little print. But they're happy with the LPD amphibious ship program. Not happy. Nobody's ever happy. But it's not a major problem area. A major problem area is not the big deck assault ship program. LHA, a big problem area is not the TAO John Lewis program, which is a GD NASCO. The big problem area is not in the DDG 51 Flight 3 program, both at Ingalls Shipbuilding, HII's Ingalls Yard, and also at Bath's BIW Yard. And, you know, this is not an all gloom and doom situation. But the way people are talking about it, and they let the narrative kind of drive that, is that everything is screwed up, everything is terrible, what are we going to do? And it's not all bad. Not only that, but the shipyards and all these shipbuilding companies will be happy to talk to you about the investments that they're making, all the changes that they're doing in response to this. They're not doing nothing is the underlying message. And that you'll get that down on the floor when you walk the floor. And that's that is very much part of the story. I'm not sure what you're going to hear in the panel discussions up on the third deck there, but I'm looking to hear that. I want to hear what industry. I'll say one more thing that I would like to see, and that is, will there be more displays about directed energy weapons? And you know, the surf boss, the new Surf Four commander, Brennan McLean, at Service Navy Association in January, started off his entire address, "Where are my lasers? How come I don't have lasers? You told me I was going to have all these lasers. They'd be bringing down unmanned systems. And now we are in combat against unmanned systems on a daily basis. Where are my lasers?" Different optical dazzlers. Oh, there's a whole family of them. And they've downgraded that story. They're not doing briefings on the DG-51 class, which is, so we really know what they're doing. And I want to see, is industry has now has time to respond to those comments in January, which were very direct. And is industry going to be out on the floor? Hey, we have this puppy. We have this toy. We have this gadget. We have this device. Try this, try that. It's all ready to go, whatever. I'll be looking to see if that's out there.
Yeah, I'll finish up. I mean, you guys really covered most of what I was going to say. I'll start with where you finished, Chris. I'm really interested in the counter UAS. What are we going to see? There's a number of folks that have kind of put stuff out. BAE is going to do a briefing on that, so I'm looking forward to hearing from them. I hope we'll see other vendors, especially small vendors, kind of bringing new approaches to that. I'll give Brian a hat tip, because I know that he's been beating that laser drum for a while and helping the folks out at SurfPAC and throughout the surface world kind of articulate that demand. So I'm looking forward to seeing what type of new technology we see on the floor in response to what we heard at SNA. And then I hope industry will take, not in a negative way, but in a positive way, the opportunity to really explain to not just the Navy leadership, but sort of the mid-grade leadership, what are the real challenges that they're dealing with? Because I think sometimes folks in uniform don't get it. They think that, you know, industry is money grubbing, that it's all about stock buybacks and you know, inflating the price of the stock. And there are some real issues that they're dealing with across the supply base. And I think it's important that the Navy and the naval community understands that. We heard a little bit of that from Chris Kastner yesterday. Unfortunately, it kind of got buried in some of the stories. Hopefully we'll see more of that. But I hope CEOs and vice presidents of these units really explain that so that the Navy gets a sense of where investment could be helpful and how we can start to dig out. Because to Jerry and Brian's point, there are a lot of good things to feel good about. There are a lot of things that the Navy should be proud of. So that that mix, I think, will be important. Look, if it's all happy talk or if it's all doom and gloom, I fear that it will not be the best use of time. I really like what Jerry said. It should be that adult conversation where we take advantage of our successes and we point out where we need to get better.
Well, folks, we got to go. We have talked and talked and talked. And I think all four of us are people who can talk about this all day long and most of the night. We've been joined by Jerry Hendricks and Brian McGrath, two of the finest naval analysts out there. Brian and Jerry, thanks for coming back on the podcast. We hope to have you back again soon. Have a great show next week.
Thank you, you too.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Well, that does it for this week. As always, our thanks go out to Vagra Maradian and the Defense and Aerospace Group for their support. Chris and I will both be at Navy League Sea Air and Space Exposition in National Harbor this week. If you see us, please stop and say hi.
The Cavalry Ships Podcast is sponsored by HII. Join HII at the Navy League Sea Air Space Expo at the Gaylord National Convention Center, April 8th through 10th. HII is committed to delivering the platforms and technologies from aircraft carriers and Flight 3 destroyers to C5ISR and LVC solutions that create the advantage for our customers as they protect peace and freedom around the world. HII at booth 1323. And by GE Aerospace. The LM2500 family of marine gas turbines are renowned for being the workhorse for the U.S. Navy and 38 navies around the world. Find out more about GE Aerospace's marine engines and systems at geaerospace.com/marine.
Be sure to follow us at Cavis Ships on Twitter. And remember, this podcast is available on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, SoundCloud, and Spotify. I'm Chris Cervello.
And I'm Chris Cavis. Thanks for listening, and bye-bye.